Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. I'm a resident. This is episode 206 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. And in this podcast, I'm going to begin a family medicine shelf exam rapid review series. I'll just be doing a bunch of cases that highlight topics and concepts that are commonly tested on the family medicine exam. It will be completely random. But hopefully, as you listen to this series and as I build up this series, you'll find it to be very helpful for the exam. So let's just jump right into it. So the first thing I think I want to start with is talking through like an algorithm that's frequently tested on the family medicine shelf. And that is the algorithm that relates to a thyroid nodule, right? So if a person has a thyroid nodule, what is always your first step in diagnosis? If you're a person, you know, on physical exam, you palpate a thyroid nodule, what is always your first step in diagnosis? Well, I would really hope that you're thinking that you'd want to go ahead and measure the TSH, right? Because the thing is, when you measure the TSH, that will help you delineate between the person potentially having a hot nodule or a cold nodule, okay? A hot nodule or a cold nodule. So you measure the TSH. And basically, the way I teach people this concept is, essentially, if the TSH is low, you know you're dealing with a hot nodule, right? Because the algorithm can get complicated real fast if you try to overcomplicate things, right? So the best thing to just say, ask yourself is the TSH low? If the TSH is low, it's a hot nodule. If the TSH is not low, so any other results, be it normal, high, whatever, it doesn't matter, then it goes into the TSH not low pile. So let's talk about the TSH low pile, right? So if the TSH is low, kind of pile, right? Then we know we're dealing with a hot nodule, right? And once a person has a hot nodule, right, the thing is the chance of like thyroid cancer, because when you see a thyroid nodule, right, the thing that freaks you out is thyroid cancer, right? If the TSH is low, you know it's a hot nodule, super low risk of cancer. So your next step in diagnosis on an MBM exam will be to order a RIU scan, okay? You want to be able to reinterpret those RIU scan results, right? So if, for example, a person, you get a RIU scan and you find like a single hot spot on the RIU scan, that's going to be a toxic adenoma, right? That's pretty easy. But what if they told you that, oh, you see multiple hot spots? What are you thinking about under those circumstances? Well, I hope you're telling me that it's a toxic multi-nodular goiter, right? Okay. And then what if they tell you that there's a diffusely increased uptake on the RIU scan? What are you thinking about? Well, that'll be Graves' disease, right? That'll be Graves' disease, right? That'll be Graves' disease, right? So whenever you see those kinds of things, think about, again, those are kind of like the big things you want to keep at the back of your mind with a RIU scan. And I'll say some quick things at the end, but let me talk about like the other part of this algorithm, right? So the other part of the algorithm, if the TSH is not low, right, that means you have a cold nodule, right? The problem with cold nodules is most of them are benign. About 70% of them, 70-75%, they're like colloid cysts in the thyroid. But you know, you can never be sure of that, right? So typically after that, you want to do like an FNA with ultrasound, right? So you can get like some thyroid tissue and send it off to a pathologist, right? And you know, if you see a cancer, you want to know like some quick, for the family medicine shelf, you don't need, again, need to go all super in depth on these cancers, but you need to kind of know some of them, right? And like some key things, right? So say for example, right, they tell you that you see sarcoma bodies, right, from a pathology specimen of a cold thyroid nodule. What kind of cancer are you thinking about? Well, I hope you're thinking about papillary thyroid cancer, right? Remember, papillary thyroid cancer is popular, right? So it's the most common kind of thyroid cancer. And don't forget the biggest risk factor for that, right, which is a history of exposure to head and neck radiation, right? So remember, papillary thyroid cancer, it all actually loves to spread through lymph nodes. The reason I'm saying that is there's another kind of thyroid cancer, follicular thyroid cancer, that loves to spread hematogenously. It doesn't spread via lymph nodes, right? So that's something you want to keep at the back of your mind for exams, right? So follicular thyroid cancer, hematogenous spread, but papillary thyroid cancer loves lymphatic spread. It has the best prognosis of all the thyroid cancers. It's associated with exposure to head and neck radiation. Another thing you may see on histology is the often anii nuclei, right? You may see the often anii nuclei, right? So those are the big things there. And then what if they give you a question about a person that has like a neck mass, and then they tell you that, oh, like the father, the uncle or whatever, like just a ton of family members dying of like some weird neck mass, or maybe like this person has had like hypercalcemia for whatever bizarre reason or something. If you see like multiple family members with thyroid cancer, right, I would really hope you're thinking about one of the MEN syndromes, right? In this case, it will be MEN2A or MEN2B, right? Because they likely have medullary thyroid cancer. Remember, medullary thyroid cancer has a terrible prognosis, and all people that have MEN2A2B, they need a prophylactic thyroidectomy at some point early in their lives, because it's not a matter of if they will get thyroid cancer, it's just a matter of when they will get the thyroid cancer, right? So typically for those folks, you know, you go ahead and get a prophylactic thyroidectomy. This is medullary thyroid cancer here. And what is the key histologic finding on a biopsy in a person that has medullary thyroid cancer? Well, I hope you're telling me that you'll find amyloid in the thyroid gland, right? So if they say something about a person having like apple green birefringence on Congo red staining from like a thyroid biopsy specimen, you want to think about medullary thyroid cancer, right? And remember that people that have medullary thyroid cancer, they can actually come in with like symptomatic hypocalcemia on an MBM exam, because the tumor marker for medullary thyroid cancer is calcitonin. So that calcitonin, right, can calcitone down your blood calcium levels, right? So that can cause hypocalcemia. Or if they want to get like super sneaky, they can give you like an EKG on your family med shelf in a person that has like a neck mass, and then you see like a prolonged QT interval, right? You should again think about hypocalcemia from medullary thyroid cancer under those circumstances, right? Now, I said that at the end, I will say some other things about our, let me say one more thing. So what if they tell you that, oh, from this thyroid nodule, you get a biopsy specimen of the thyroid and you see a lot of like lymphoid follicles? What are you thinking about under those circumstances? Well, I would hope you're thinking about a person having like Hashimoto's, right? Remember, the most common cause of hypothyroidism in the US is Hashimoto's thyroiditis, right? Is Hashimoto's thyroiditis. And those people who have very low levels of, they can have like a thyrotoxic phase, right? But usually they present with hypothyroid symptoms. And the hypothyroidism you'll see on your exam will be something along the lines of like bradycardia, right? So usually people that are hypothyroid on MBM exams, their heart rate is usually less than 60 for whatever bizarre reason. At least probably like 80% of the MBM questions I've seen on hypothyroidism, those people almost always have bradycardia, right? And you know, they'll feel tired, they'll gain weight, they'll have like the pre-tibial myxedema and all that badness, right? And they may also have like cholesterol lab abnormalities, right? So if you see a ton of lymphoid follicles in the thyroid gland, think about Hashimoto's thyroiditis. If you also do a biopsy though, right, let's say you see a person that has had like a long history of Hashimoto's thyroiditis, and then they have like this rapidly expanding neck mass, whenever you see stuff like that, you obviously want to think about like a thyroid lymphoma. Remember, a thyroid lymphoma is actually one of the neoplastic, like potential neoplastic complications of a person having a long history of Hashimoto's thyroiditis. And remember, sometimes your friends at the MBME, right, they play this game where they will not give you the name of something you're familiar with, right? So occasionally, instead of putting Hashimoto's thyroiditis, they can put lymphocytic thyroiditis as the answer choice on an exam. That's just code word for Hashimoto's thyroiditis, right? And then if they give you a question about a person that, you know, has hyperthyroid symptoms, like their TSH is low, but you get a RIU scan and you notice, you're like, I'm not seeing any uptake whatsoever on a RIU scan. What pathology should you think about? Well, I would really, really hope that you'll think about things that fall along the lines of like factitious hyperthyroidism, right? Where a person is like taking thyroid hormone to like lose weight and all that stuff, right? Because again, if you're taking thyroid hormone exogenously, right? Yeah, you know, you'll have hyperthyroid symptoms, but that will suppress your endogenous TSH. So your thyroid gland will no longer be stimulated. So you will not have increased uptake. Another thing you may see that may cause those kinds of symptoms, although this person will have like a tender thyroid gland on an MBME exam, is the person having like a de Quervain's or like the subacute thyroiditis, right? So if a person has hyperthyroid symptoms, they have a tender thyroid gland, right? But then you see no uptake on a RIU scan. That's pathognomonic for de Quervain's thyroiditis. So you may say, Divine, okay, well, how do I tell de Quervain's thyroiditis apart from like a person exogenously taking thyroid hormone? Well, remember, I think I've said this in like multiple podcasts in the past, right? That there's this thing known as thyroglobulin. Thyroglobulin is like the C-peptide of the thyroid gland. So if a person's thyroid hormone is coming from the actual thyroid gland, the person's thyroglobulin levels will be elevated when they're in a state of thyrotoxicosis. But if the thyroid hormone is not coming from the thyroid gland, the thyroglobulin levels will be really low. So if a person is injecting thyroid hormone or, you know, taking like oral Synthroid or whatever, those people will not have elevated levels of thyroglobulin, But if a person has the Quervain's thyroiditis, right, because remember, the Quervain's thyroiditis is just generalized inflammation of the thyroid gland, right? So you have like release of preformed thyroid hormone. Whenever you see that, right, you should suspect the person, you know, having a, and again, they also have a tender thyroid gland. You should suspect that the Quervain's thyroiditis under those circumstances, right? So those are kind of like some big things you want to keep in mind there. And again, remember your MEN syndromes, they're just sort of kind of thyroid related. So let's talk about those, right? So remember, right, those things have autosomal dominant inheritance. There's MEN one where they'll have like parathyroid, like primary hyperparathyroidism, right? So they can have hypercalcemia. They can have like pituitary adenomas, most commonly like a prolactinoma. But remember, those people can also have, so the prolactinoma, right, obviously will cause like gynecomastia, galactorrhea, infertility, because prolactin is a suppressor of GnRH, right? And then they can also have another pituitary thing they can have, right? They can also have like a growth hormone secreting tumor, right? So they can have like acromegaly, right? So like, oh, like the spaces between their teeth is increased, they have frontal bossing, their friends don't recognize them anymore, their rings don't fit, their hats don't fit, and they can get like a hypertrophic cardiomyopathy and die from that, right? So that's actually the most common cause of death in people with acromegaly, right? And then remember that they can also get pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors, they can get insulinomas, right? That will have like the classically described Whipple's triad, right? So like they'll have hypoglycemia, signs of hypoglycemia, and then their symptoms get better with glucose augmentation, right? Or they can get like a glucagonoma, right? So if you see a person that's like developing like new onset diabetes, right, they've never had a history of diabetes, and then weirdly they develop diabetes, and you're like, and this person has like a skin rash, like a necrotic skin rash, think about a glucagonoma under those circumstances, right? So the classically described necrolytic migratory erythema, right, that's a pathognomonic thing you may see on an MBM exam. And then also do not forget that if a person has another pancreatic neuroendocrine tumor, I guess, that can show up, right, is like a gastrinoma, right? So those people can have like the Zollinger-Ellison syndrome. So, you know, you see these people that seem to have like these very virulent ulcers, right? Especially if you see ulcers in the jejunum of the small bowel, right? That's super unusual. That's not H. pylori. That's Zollinger-Ellison syndrome, right? And usually those people tend to have chronic diarrhea as well, right? And then I guess maybe the final pancreatic neuroendocrine tumor I should talk about here is the VIPoma, right? Remember, VIPomas tend to present with the WDHA syndrome, right? Where you have like watery diarrhea, they'll have like hypokalemia, they'll have achlorhydria, right? Again, those are all classic things you may see with MEN1. And again, it's autosomal dominant inheritance. MEN2A, right? They can have the primary hyperparathyroidism, but those people can also have pheochromocytomas, right? So the pheos, right? You'll see like the episodic headache and hypertension, and obviously for that you want to check the levels of metanephrines and catecholamines in the urine, right? You'll be elevated, and then you do like a CT scan of the abdomen or an MRI of the abdomen, or you do like the nuclear medicine test, which we classically call like an MIBG scan to establish the diagnosis, right? And then those people can also have medullary thyroid cancer, which I've talked about already, right? And then MEN2B, right? Those people do not get calcium problems, they don't get the primary hyperparathyroidism. Or they can get the pheochromocytoma, right? They can get the Marfanoid habitus, right? So they can be like super tall and all that jazz, right? And then they can also have the pheochromocytomas, right? And then they can also have the mucosal neuromas, like the growths on mucosal surfaces. Usually it's the lips on an MBM exam, right? So hopefully you feel comfortable with these thyroid pathologies. Again, they are all high yield things that tend to pop up on exams, right? So that's something I definitely know if I were you preparing for any of these exams. And then one thing I found to be high yield for these family medicine exams is knowing the cholesterol screening guidelines, right? So those are things that people, unfortunately, tend to not know very well. They're kind of detailed, so, you know, they're kind of one of those annoying things that you need to, like, sort of furnish in the back of your mind for exams, right? So, again, there are many guidelines here, but let me give you, like, the Cliff's Notes version that you want to keep at the back of your mind, right? So there are basically four groups of people that should get statins on MBM exams, right? So the first group is easy. Do you have an LDL cholesterol, not total cholesterol? Because the MBM, they love to gimp people with this on exams. You know, they'll put like people that have like elevated like total cholesterol and try to get you to pick giving those people statins. That's not always the case, right? So if a person has an LDL cholesterol, not total cholesterol, LDL cholesterol more than, you know, 190, right? So 190 or higher. So if it's 189, doesn't fall, but 190 or higher, right? Go ahead and give those people a statin, right? And again, usually you give like high intensity statins like atorvastatin or rosuvastatin, right? And then if a person has like a really bad like atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease, right? Like they have coronary artery disease, they've had stroke, they have peripheral arterial disease, whatever. For those people, they also deserve high intensity statins. And again, remember, atorvastatin and rosuvastatin are your high intensity statins, right? And then if you have diabetes and your LDL cholesterol is more than 70, right? And you are over the, you're basically between the ages of 40 to 75. The way I just think about it is, are you a diabetic? Is your cholesterol more than 70? Are you more than 40 years old? That's it. You get a high intensity statin as well. But if you're also over the age of 40 and your cholesterol is just above 70, right? But you notice that this person's ASCVD risk is more than 7.5%, so 7.5%. Those people also deserve high intensity statins, right? So again, I'll reel them out. So LDL greater than 190, so greater than or equal to 190, right? If you've had like really bad atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease, so that the classic ones on exams, MI, stroke, PAD, right? Or if you're a diabetic and your cholesterol is greater than 70 and you're over the age of 40, right? Your LDL cholesterol greater than 70 and you're over the age of 40, you also get a high intensity statin. And then if you're over the age of 40, right? I mean, if you want to be more strict, like between 40 and 75, and you don't, again, you don't have diabetes, but your LDL cholesterol is over 70, but your ASCVD risk is more than 7.5%, those people also deserve high-intensity statins on an MBME exam, right? And that ASCVD score, you don't need to memorize how to calculate it. It's something that you would typically get on an MBME exam, right? And again, remember, your high-intensity statins are things like atorvastatin and rosuvastatin, right? And then one other thing that your friends at the MBME love to test on exams are like these vitamin deficiencies, right? So let's maybe run through the vitamins. That's probably where I'll stop today because it's a fairly large topic, right? So let's maybe go through the B vitamins, right? So vitamin B1, right? So vitamin B1 is thiamine, right? So what are the high yield things you want to keep at the back of your mind for your family medicine shelf with thiamine? The big ones you want to keep at the back of your mind, one, you want to think about like an alcoholic, right? So alcoholics, right? They can get Wernicke-Korsakoff syndrome. Remember, Wernicke-Korsakoff syndrome arises because you have issues with transketolase. Transketolase is one of those key enzymes in the non-oxidative phase of the pentose phosphate pathway, right? So transketolase uses thiamine, vitamin B1 as a cofactor. So if you're an alcoholic, you know, you deplete your B1. If you deplete your B1, then you can get into trouble, right? Like having Wernicke-Korsakoff syndrome. And remember, Wernicke's, right, is the triad of a person having a confusion, right? Ophthalmoplegia. Ophthalmoplegia is just code word for any eye problem. And then ataxia, right? If you see that, that's Wernicke's, that's reversible, right? You give IV thiamine for that. And you give the thiamine before you give glucose, right? But if you take that triad and add on to it things like a person making stuff up, right? So like confabulations, or the person having like disorganized movements like ataxia, then that's Korsakoff's. Korsakoff's is also treated with IV thiamine, but it's irreversible, right? It's irreversible. And then one other thing that you may see with thiamine problems on an exam is a person that has hyperemesis gravidarum, right? So if they describe a first trimester pregnant woman vomiting a ton, those people actually have a pretty high risk of Wernicke's. So those people actually deserve vitamin B1, like IV vitamin B1 when they come to the hospital, in addition to the antiemetics that you're giving them, right? And usually on MBME exams, those people have a metabolic acidosis. They'll have like a hypokaloremic metabolic alkalosis. Whoops, I take that back. Metabolic alkalosis, right? Because you're vomiting stomach acid, right? So you become alkalotic from that. And also because you're vomiting a ton, right? You become volume depleted. So the activity of your urine angiotensin aldosterone system goes up, right? So aldosterone will dump all those protons at the level of the amphora intercalated cell of the collecting of the distal nephron, right? So you get a metabolic alkalosis there. And you're hypochloremic, right? Because you are vomiting hydrochloric acid, literally, right? So those are the big things to know with thiamine. And remember, thiamine has that neuroanatomical association with hemorrhagic infarctions of the mammillary bodies, right? So that's something you want to keep in mind. And then having a thiamine deficiency, right, can also cause wet beriberi, right? That's like a dilated cardiomyopathy, again, that you can find in a chronic alcoholic, right? Because again, if thiamine is not working, you may say, Divine, why is that? Well, if thiamine doesn't work, I don't know, some key pathways in your body, I don't know, like maybe like the pyruvate dehydrogenase complex is not going to work. So your TCA, basically the gateway to your TCA cycle is shut, right? So you're not going to be able to make ATP, right? And if you're not making ATP, right, your cells will begin to fail. They'll be essentially have like it's almost like a metabolic ischemia in a sense, right? So you get into trouble and you can get a dilated cardiomyopathy, which is essentially wet beriberi. It's called wet beriberi because if your heart doesn't work, you have edema everywhere, right? Now, vitamin B2, riboflavin, that's not really tested on the Family Med shelf, so I'm going to move on from that. Vitamin B3 is niacin, right? Niacin certainly is tested, right? Pellagra, right? And there are many things that can cause pellagra in your test, right? So, you know, if you don't eat foods that are rich enough in B3, well, you're kind of screwed there. That's one. But another thing that can kind of screw you over as well is if you have like carcinoid syndrome, right? Remember, carcinoid syndrome is where you have like a GI mass that makes a ton of serotonin. Well, think about it. Serotonin is known as 5-HT for a reason, right? 5-hydroxytryptophan, right? So that means it's derived from tryptophan. Well, guess what? What do you think we used to make niacin? We also use tryptophan to make niacin, right? So if you shunt all your tryptophan towards making serotonin, well, you're going to get pellagra with that, right? Or if you have like heart knob disease, where you have trouble reabsorbing like neutral amino acids like tryptophan at the level of the proximal convoluted tubule, right? You'll also get a niacin deficiency then. You can get into trouble, all right? And then what are the things you find with niacin deficiency, aka pellagra, right? You know, you have the 4 Ds, right? So like diarrhea, dermatitis, dementia, and death, right? So those are all things to keep at the back of your mind for exams. Vitamin B5 pantothenic acid, that's step one, so I'm going to skip that. There's no vitamin B4, at least I don't think. Yeah, I'm pretty sure, actually I'm certain there's no vitamin B4. It's only if they've discovered vitamin B4 and I'm not aware of it. But vitamin B6 is definitely high, you ought to know for exams, right? That's pyridoxal phosphate. There are many different contexts that you could see this in on an MBM exam, right? So, especially on a family medicine shelf, right? Probably the classic one would be like TB treatment, right? Your doctor says, ooh, you're taking isoniazid. I would really love you to take this vitamin alongside, right? You're like, doc, I don't think you really know what you're talking about. Or maybe you read like Dr. Google and, you know, read some crap online. Well, fine. I wish you all the best with your sideroblastic anemia, right? So what are the things that B6 can cause, right? So B6 can cause sideroblastic anemia, right? Because remember, if you remember from step one, there's this enzyme known as ALAS, like ALA synthase. That's like the rate-limiting enzyme of heme synthesis. Well, it needs B6 as a cofactor, right? So, you know, if your B6 is not working, if you don't have B6, because isoniazid depletes your B6, if your B6 is not working, right, then ALAS will not work. You won't make heme, so you get a sideroblastic anemia. Another thing that can also happen is you can also get seizures, right, from a B6 deficiency, right? So, because again, remember, glutamate is an excitatory neurotransmitter, at least of the central nervous system, like the brain. And then GABA is the inhibitory neurotransmitter of the brain, right? So GABA is inhibitory, kind of calms you down. Glutamate is super excitatory, kind of spruces you up, right? So if you have like B6 deficiency, there's this enzyme known as GAD, glutamate decarboxylase, that will not work. And GAD converts glutamate to GABA, right? So if GAD doesn't work because the cofactor is not around, then your glutamate will rise, your GABA will plummet. And because you have high glutamate, you have too much excitation, you can get seizures, right? And then you can also get like LFT abnormalities, right? Because again, you see all those transaminases that you learn about, ALT, AST, blah, 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 right? Well, what's the cofactor used by your transaminases? It's vitamin B6, right? So if your vitamin B6 does not work, that explains why isoniazid is potentially hepatotoxic as well, right? So those are all things you want to keep in mind on exams. Vitamin B7, biotin, I'm going to skip that. That's more step one further. B8, there's no vitamin B8, at least as far as I know. But B9 folate, you know, kind of high yield to know, right? So if you're the kind of person that does a tea and toast diet, well, you can get a folate problem, right? And folate can cause a megaloblastic anemia, right? So the MCV will be more than 100. And those people can also get like hyperhomocysteinemia. Although remember that people that have a folate deficiency will not get methylmalonic acidemia, right? Because remember, it's B12 deficiency. That's cobalamin. It's B12 deficiency that will cause the methylmalonic acidemia in addition to the megaloblastic anemia and hyperhomocysteinemia. Because if you remember from step one, with your all-chain fatty acids, right? Like if you want to go from like from methylmalonyl CoA to succinyl CoA, you need methylmalonyl CoA mutase for that to happen, right? So, you know, if you have a B12 deficiency, the enzyme methylmalonyl CoA mutase will not work because B12 is its cofactor, so you get a methylmalonic acidemia from that. And then remember, right, B12 can also cause all these other problems, right? Like subacute combined degeneration of the spinal cord. So like your dorsal columns, your corticospinal tract won't work. So those people have problems with like fine touch, vibration, proprioception. They will have like upper motor neuron symptoms, kind of deal, right? You know, so those are things to keep in mind. And then remember, right, folate deficiency, right, classic in people that are taking anti-epileptic drugs. And B12 deficiency, right, if you're a vegan, right, like an unwise vegan, you know, you don't take like B12 supplements. Because remember, B12 comes from animal products, right? Remember, folate comes from foliage, right? So if you're taking, if you're a vegan, you're not going to get a folate deficiency, but you'll definitely get a B12 deficiency, especially if you're like a prolonged, like you're like a long-termer, you're a long-termer vegan, right? So, let's see, is there any other vitamin stuff I want to talk about or mineral stuff? If a person has like dysgeusia, so, you know, like impaired taste sensation, or a person has alopecia, right? That's classic zinc deficiency. And I mean, there are many things that can cause zinc deficiency, right? Like if you're on TPN for a long time, right? Or if you have Wilson's disease, believe it or not, right? If you have Wilson's disease and it's being treated and you're not supplementing zinc, that can also cause problems, because one of the treatments for Wilson's disease is a copper chelator known as trientine. So T-R-I-E-N-T-I-N-E. Well, in addition to being able to chelate copper, it's actually pretty good at chelating zinc, right? So you can get a zinc deficiency that way, right? And then vitamin C deficiency, right? So the person will have like mucosal bleeds. They'll have, because collagen doesn't work very well. Because remember from step one, if you want to like hydroxylate like proline and lysine residues, you kind of need vitamin C for that. So you have like, you know, like a kind of like screwed up collagen synthesis when you have a vitamin C deficiency. So you essentially have like scurvy, they'll have like bleeding gums and all that crap. And then don't forget, right? If they give you a question about a person that has like a malabsorptive disorder, right? That's basically like a gateway to like fat soluble vitamin deficiency questions on exams, right? So like night blindness with like vitamin A deficiency, or like osteoporosis or secondary hyperparathyroidism with a vitamin D deficiency, right? Because remember, right, like if you have a fat malabsorption, then by default, you are not able to resorb your A, D, E, and K vitamins, or vitamin E deficiency, right? That'll be like the person may have like acanthocytosis on a blood smear, and they will also have ataxia, because again, if you remember from step one, it's kind of phenomenal how step one actually is really helpful for step two. Like doing, like knowing your step one material well really helps on step two, at least in my experience. Vitamin E deficiency can cause ataxia, right? Because from step one, if you remember your spinal cerebellar tracts, the proper myelination of this of those tracts depends on vitamin E, right? And then vitamin K, they can get like all these, vitamin K deficiency, they can get all these bleeds. So I guess your major question here may be like, oh, Divine, what are the things that can cause fat malabsorption? Well, a bunch of stuff, right? So let's assume your terminal ileum has been resected because you have Crohn's disease. Well, you're not going to be reabsorbing many fats that way. And that can also cause B12 deficiency, right? Or if a person has like cystic fibrosis on a family medicine shelf, if you have CF, right, your pancreas, right, you have like an endocrine and exocrine pancreatic defect, right, because your pancreatic secretions are very thick, right, so you're not making lipase, you know, so that can cause problems. Or let's assume you have celiac disease, right? Celiac disease can also cause a fat malabsorption, because again, one of the areas you can torch in your GI tract is your terminal ileum in celiac. Right? Remember, you want to avoid gluten containing foods in those people. And then if you, you know, if you've drank alcohol for, you know, pretty long portion of your life, and then they tell you that, oh, the person has had recurrent episodes of abdominal pain, that's chronic pancreatitis, right? Pancreas is shot, no more lipase, right? So you're kind of screwed from that perspective. So I think those are kind of like the key vitamins and minerals, you know, you want to commit to memory for your exams. One thing that just dropped in my mind, let me just see this for completeness sake, because again, the family medicine shelf covers like kids to adults, right? So if you see a newborn with like big tongue, like a big tongue, beefy red tongue, has an umbilical hernia, has macroglossia, right? That's pretty classic for congenital hypothyroidism, right? And usually the most common cause there is like thyroid dysgenesis, right? So again, these are just all things you want to keep at the back of your mind. And I will try really hard. It's just, again, time that's my big limiting factor here. But I'll try really hard to hopefully make some more family medicine related shelf podcasts as time goes on. But I'll just make them rapid review series. It'll be a comprehensive library at the end. It'll just take a while to get to, right? So I'm going to go ahead and pause here. Again, as I do at the end of every podcast, I do offer one-on-one tutoring for many exams. Step 1, 2CK, 2CS, Step 3. Preclinical med school exams, third year shelf exams, if you're a medicine resident, the ABIM board exam, the medicine in training exam, or if you're a college student that needs tutoring for the MCAT, or you need tutoring for like general chemistry, organic chemistry, physics, biochemistry, histology, physiology, I tutor for all those things. And then I do like these booster courses. It's like 15 hours for step 2 CK, step 3. It's like 20 hours for step 1, where again, I review like the must knows, like right before you take like your USMLE exams. Again, I've done it with a ton of people, super successful with that stuff. And then I do like comprehensive USMLE reviews. I just need a group of 5 to 7 people. So if you have a group, you know, just reach out to me and I'll be happy to kind of give you some more details. And then again, as I've said in prior podcasts, I think that's maybe like episode 204 or something like that. There's this podcast I made recently on USMLE and the military. So the USMLE has started focusing these days on like military servicemen and women, and also like geriatric like folks. I'll make a geriatric podcast like actually very soon. But that stuff's tested on the exam. So please, before you take step 2 CK or step 1 or step 3, I promise you, you'll literally be shortchanging yourself if you do not listen to the podcast on like USMLE and the military. It's one of the more recent podcasts I made. It's like some episode above 200 or something like that. So, you know, just listen to it, get your free points and move on from that. So, if you need details on, again, on any of these things, or let's say you're a med student applying to residency, so like an ERAS application, or a college student applying to med school, so like an AMCAS application. So you know, you need help with like editing your application, editing your personal statements, doing mock interviews, rec letters. Again, reach out to me. Again, I've done this with a ton of people. More than 90% of the people I've worked with have matched at their first choices. And I also have like admissions committee experience. I've been on the admissions committee of a top 2 med school for a year. So again, I have a lot of experience with this stuff. So, you know, if you need any of those things, either reach out to me through the website, or you send me an email at divineinterventionpodcasts with an S at the end at gmail.com. So have a wonderful rest of your day. God bless you. I'll see you next time. Thank you.